Let's get it started. Hey there, welcome to the SaaS Unbound podcast. I am your host today, Tobias Schlottke. I look different from Anna, as you might have noticed, and I'm CTO and co-founder of SaaS Group, and I'm joining for a special series here where I chat with product and development experts all about all things SaaS. So I'm co-founder of SaaS Group, serial acquirer, buying wonderful PLG SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And my guest today is Andreas Creighton, co-founder and CEO at Made with Love. Andreas, welcome. What does Made with Love do?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for the nice introduction. I'm indeed the founder of Made with Love. We help startups and scale-ups with our technical teams. So we have a bunch of CTOs in our company and staff engineers that help CTOs scale up their team, help get teams level up. And if there is no CTO, for example, if the CTO left or is on the leave or something, we can also step in as a CTO at interim. We also do quite some technical due diligence. So we audit companies for investors, typically in the Series A to B context. And on top of that, because we find that our customers have quite some difficulties finding the right talent as well, we also provide recruitment service from CTO to engineer. That's it in a nutshell, I guess.
Thanks. I don't know if you knew, but I also run a podcast under like alphalist.com, which is a CTO community that I co-founded as well. It's more like a hobby. And my intro question is always like, what is your nerd path? Like, how did you get into computing? Like, why do you love doing that? Why do you love what you do? So why do you do Made with Love?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first of all, I like to create things. One thing is you're an entrepreneur. You like to do things. I mean, I have other ventures in totally different fields. I have a company that creates frozen pizza dough, for example. So those are different things. And I think like one of the things that you realize very early if you're an engineer is that you like to create things. And for me, the way of creating things is through code. And I'm still coding every day. So that's what I love to do as well. So that's where that urge comes from. And if you look at what we're doing with Made with Love, for me, the most important thing, what you're trying to do there is bridge the gap between non-technical people and technical teams, because that's something I realized throughout my career. That's probably the edge that I bring and that my team also, in to extent, brings is to be able to translate the technical language into a non-technical, towards non-technical people, for them to understand what the technical people are saying, and the other way around, to try to explain the business needs and the economic realities towards engineering teams and make them aware of those. So bridging that gap is what drives us for doing Made with Love, and it's in everything that we do that we apply that.
And what was the language you used when you coded last time?
My main language is PHP. So I do PHP, JavaScript, but I've been doing everything except for .NET, I guess.
Okay, except from .NET. Yeah. Is that good or bad that you don't do .NET? I mean
it's a totally different thing. The fact that you have to pay a license, I'm not so much aware of the ecosystem anymore. But the fact that when I started like 13 years old and you had to pay a license or something to be able to use a server or whatever it was, that was something that kept me away. So that's how I went with PHP. Yeah.
But coming back to Made with Love, as SaaS Group, you're also remote first, right? I mean, since Corona, that all changed and got easier, but still you need a strategy on how you operate your company, right? Like what's your idea? What's your idea on creating culture in a remote setup, and how do you run your shop?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that we've been remote from more or less the start. The company exists for 17 years now. We used to have an office where everyone was co-located, but then people had to travel like sometimes 2 hours to get there. And so when the lease of our first office, which I guess we had 3 years, was ending, we decided, okay, let's not have one office anymore. And so basically we decided to move people closest to where they live. And I think there is some flavors in remotes. When we made that switch, one of the first things I installed is we don't want to have digital nomads in our team. So we want to have people that are physically on the same location most of the time, because we had those, and then you have problems with internet connections and availability and stuff like that. So basically for me, it's about not being co-located in the same space. But other than that, I don't think it changes anything to how you work. And that made us come up with the term, like, I guess, remote first. We're fully remote. But for example, I come to an office every day, and there's two other co-workers of mine who are sitting here. We have another office somewhere else in Belgium where there was, I think, three people most of the time as well. I've been in that office once, to give you an idea. It's 1 hour away. So for me, it's not where you are, but it's how you work together. So yeah, what's important to me when you're doing remote is that you do it properly. That means that everyone is on the same page. So if you sometimes come into companies where they allow people to work from home or they have a couple of people remotely, and I see, for example, that they do like a team meeting and when there is like one person calling in on the laptop and the other people are standing around that, I mean, that's basically you're setting that person behind in terms of interaction. So for me, what remote first is about is that whenever you do something, you factor in that some people might not be present on the same place, so that basically you try to make the experience the same for everyone. So in that case, I would suggest for everyone to go behind their computer, put on a headphone, and have the same delay in the connection, have the same way of raising your hand in Zoom or whatever you're using. So that everyone is equal. And of course, your question was on the culture. Let's be very honest on that. The culture is going to be different if you're a remote company than if you're a co-located company. I've never been for the kind of work hard, play hard mentality where like soccer tables in office and stuff like that. That's not something that works for me. I've never played football. I don't really care about that. So if you want to have that and if you want to have the water cooler moments and stuff like that, probably you want to go more into a really office context, and you cannot really mimic that in a remote context. There is ways to do that, and we try to foster that, but you cannot expect that to be the same. So you cannot lift that culture that you have in an office towards remote. That's just something that, I mean, it's an expectation that you're never going to reach. So what we do is our culture is built up around knowledge and respect, I guess, where basically most of the interactions we have with each other is about knowledge sharing, is about making sure that everyone understands like what we care about and what we're working towards. But I guess we know way less about the personal lives of our people than if you would be in a co-located context. Although we have some techniques that we use to still gather a little bit of information. For example, every Monday, everyone writes, okay, what they worked on the week before. They write what they plan to work on in the week ahead. But then also, for example, most of the people put in some personal stuff like, this is what I did over the weekend, or I had a birthday happening last week, and put in some pictures to get some kind of an idea what's happening in people's private lives. And for example, we have this system we call it Coffee Neo, where basically every week you get paired up with a random other person in the team to have like a short, like 30 minutes, like one-on-one, not only with your manager, but just with a random person in the company. So we have all these kind of little techniques that we use to foster a bit more collaboration and social sharing as well. But it's obviously going to be different than if you're in a physical office together. Yeah.
Do you do any, I don't know, games or something?
Yeah, yes, we do. I mean, not everyone is a gamer. I'm not a gamer at all. So it's then hard to find like, okay, I mean, if you're going to do gaming, for sure. But I'm not going to join in because I wouldn't even know how to start. We had some chess competitions, for example. Also, I'm not a chess player, so it's hard for me to get into that. But lately, I think every Friday, we play GeoGuessr. I don't know if you know that. It's like guessing places. Like it's a get Google Maps and you have to guess where you are. So you get Street View. You have to guess where you are. And it's you can do it in teams as well. So that's a very accessible game that you can play in a team. And we have a couple of these kind of things. This Friday, for example, as far as I know, someone on the team and everyone can come up with these kind of stuff, ask for everyone to send in like one song that defines them. And so on Friday, there will be a quiz like where we listen to some of the tracks and try to guess like who submitted that track. So these kind of simple things, but it's fun. Yeah. And of course, we have a company retreat every year where we for 5 days are together. And that's really important as well, of course, to do that.
And I mean, you mentioned that you like basically you don't have the water cooler, right? And you don't believe in like everyone playing or working hard, playing hard. But how do you create in a remote world those brilliant high intensity moments that you tend to have in an office every once in a while, like where you have that 10x developer, right? And that 10x developer drags along others when solving a certain problem.
Yeah, we do that through pair programming.
Pair programming. Yeah.
So we do quite a lot of pair programming. So we help a lot. So our engineers work mainly with engineers from customers. And sometimes you have two or three of our engineers on a project, but typically they would take roles of the team leads in our customer teams. And so we really believe in pair programming. So we will do lots of pair programming with people in those companies to educate them and to show them how we would do it. Also, code reviews, for example, are very important in that for about sharing like how things are done. But yeah, if you want to do, it's like if you would be sitting together with someone. And the nice thing about doing it through pair programming, again, is that it depends on how you organize it. But typically you have like one person doing the reasoning, the other person doing the typing, for example. And then, yeah, you can learn a lot from each other as well. And it's actually a bit more accessible if you use the right tools to do it. If you use a collaborative editor to do it, it's more accessible than if you are sitting next to the person, because then you have to hand over the keyboard and stuff like that. So in a remote context, it's sometimes even a bit easier to do that. But yeah, it's still different, that's for sure, than if you would be sitting next to each other. You're not going to have these kind of discussions around the lunch table where you all come up with a great idea that's indeed not going to happen.
And the smell is missing, yeah?
And the smell is missing.
what are your thoughts like on hiring? Like, what do you think about meritocracy? Like, do you believe in university grades, or do you believe in work experience? Like, what do you believe in more? And what do you look like if you wanna hire like a great developer remotely? What do you look at?
I think we rarely look at certifications or education. For me, in the kind of people that we hire, which are pretty senior engineers, I would look way more into the experience. And even, I mean, a CV, especially these days, is not worth a lot anymore. It's very sad to see the quality of the CVs going down because people start using ChatGPT to write them. It's very sad to see like what people are putting on it. So for me, it's about the interaction you have with the person, like how do they communicate, which is, of course, extremely important in a remote setting. Then what's important for me is also the cultural side of things. Are they aligned with our company culture, with our values? Can they bring something extra to the culture as well? That's very important to me. And then we do a technical test. So there is a technical assignment that they take where we try to understand from a technical perspective how they're doing. Because, yeah, you can put whatever you want on paper, but if you really show it, then yeah, that's totally different, of course.
I recently, like in my CTO Slack, like someone was recently posting an open source tool that is running on your computer, like invisible or invisible to Google Meet and others, and helps you to like using AI to trigger technical tests.
We do quite some interviews with people also for our customers to screen candidates. And we had actually a couple of weeks ago a deepfake applying. So someone really? Pretending to be Estonian, I believe. But we suspect that in the end it was an Indian guy. And it was really a deepfake. We took screenshots. The quality of the video was very low. So we already had our doubts when we looked at the CV. There were things that were off. So, for example, the guy was pretending to be Estonian, but then on some of his GitHub commits that was like Greek, for example. We had already our suspicion, but the CV looked good. I mean, so you give the person the interview and then they show up and the quality of the video was pretty bad. And so the person was like, yeah, can I develop a video? I have connection issues. But the thing is that the resolution of the video was bad. So it's not a connection issue. It was really like something wrong video wise. And so, yeah, we said, no, I mean, we want to have video when we're interviewing. And then we recorded the interview just to learn from it. It's something that we don't usually do. But then afterwards, we went look at the person while he was talking. You can see, for example, that sometimes the eyes were like blinking differently and stuff like that. So it was really a deepfake applying. And it was for a cybersecurity company. And actually, 2 weeks before we had that interview, FBI sent out a warning towards American companies that there were people applying to cybersecurity companies to infiltrate them. Yeah, so things get really crazy these days.
It's never gonna be boring, right?
No, exactly.
What are your thoughts on like hiring diverse?
We try to be very careful about that, so in a good way. So in our team, we try to make sure that we have a good balance. It's very hard because we're only technical people. When we talk about diversity, I think it's always easy for companies. For example, if you are a marketing agency and you want to get diverse a lot easier than an engineering team, sadly enough. And we're a small company, and for years we have been fighting that. And also in our team, I mean, we have transgenders, we have women, we have non-white males. I mean, we try to make a good mix. But the thing there is that you don't want to discriminate positively because, I mean, that's going to cause issues as well. And actually, in the end, our our finding is that we cannot control what comes out of education. And that's where the problem is. So you need to tackle the problem at the root, which is education, which is making a diverse public willing to learn how to program. And it all starts there. And for years, we were thinking, okay, as a company, we can do something about it. But in the end, we decided that actually we cannot really. And I don't want to hire, for example, women because they are women. I want to hire whoever because they're good, right? Mm. Of course, if we have, for example, two people applying for the same role, they're equally good, then we would probably go for the diverse profile. But the problem is that, for example, when you talk about hiring people in tech, because lots of companies have quotas, especially like the big ones on diversity, they are very aggressive in hiring diverse profiles. That makes basically that basically we as a smaller company don't make any chance towards those. And I think, for example, at conferences, I was talking with a colleague about that recently. At conferences, for example, they also try to get more diversity on stage, which I am absolutely in favor for. But then I think it's very sad sometimes that the quality of the talks is lower because of that. So it's always a very hard balance, and it's a very sensitive topic, of course. But in our case, what we look at is basically the qualities of the person, and we don't really care about the background or the what they identify as.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense, right? The bad thing is that, unfortunately, if you have like kids and you have girls, then it's still very likely that they will tell you at a certain point that they don't like math in school, right?
Yeah.
For, yeah, various reasons, because they...
Yeah, but I think my daughter is 8, I think.
Yeah.
And she's very good at math, for example. But the thing is, it's also about like in a school context, they might get pushed toward other things than maths, because of their gender, and it all starts there at that age already.
Yeah, that's what I also feel like. I also have a daughter; she's 7 years old. Same thing, and she likes math, or she is good at math. She's good in playing chess, etc. But you still get, there's still that old message which comes from somewhere that you basically have to dislike math.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's the root cause. So coming back to your ideas and frameworks and tools, like you're applying free range management, right? Can you explain the concepts of free range management?
So it's basically the title of a book that I've co-authored. And the idea is that when you manage knowledge workers, right, it's very important. So it's not applying for any kind of company. If you give them the space to do their work, they'll do their work better. So it's basically the opposite would be micromanaging. It's the term free range is like if you buy eggs in the supermarket, there is two types of eggs you can buy, right? There's eggs from chicken that are like mass feeded and grown very quickly, and there is like the free range, the chicken that get out every day and see the sunlight, and the quality of the eggs will be better. And that's what we believe in as well in terms of how you manage people. If you give them the space and the freedom and responsibility and the trust to do their work, the outcome will be better. That's more or less the gist of it.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
And what do you think about accountability? Like, I mean, big freedom also is not great for everyone. And often if you don't define clear rules, you lose accountability. How do you see that?
Yeah, I think as a manager, you're responsible for creating that context of like, okay, what do I expect from you? Describe the role very well. So for example, in our team, we have something that we call the responsible developer. So every developer in our team We expect them to be responsible for their own work. So for me, it's like you are your own project manager. If something goes wrong or if you need help, you shout out. We're not going to go and chase you and ask you every hour, how are you doing on that ticket? Are you progressing? How you want to progress? Do you need help? No, people need to be proactive and they need to reach out. Okay, I'm stuck here. Can someone help? Or if they're done with something, they'll reach out to the customer or to their project manager to say, okay, I'm done with what I'm doing. What else can I do? I put a post on LinkedIn on that recently, which went viral. The difference between pull developer and push developer, where basically a pull developer waits for information to then start on doing their task. And when the task is done, they just wait for the task to be assigned to them. While a push developer is basically, okay,
give me a ticket, right?
Give me a ticket. What else can I work on?
Yes.
And that's the kind of people that we want in our team. Of course, there's other contexts where you want to have pull developers. We are much in favor of the push developer type. And with those kind of people, you can really take them and bring them to the next level and get lots of value out of that. And that's really where we believe in. And if you give them the right context and the right environment to do that, the right support as well, that's what it's all about. It's about you mentor people, you don't manage.
Do you have a concept of like assigned mentorships or something? Like when someone joins you?
In our company, so when you when you join our team, you get a buddy assigned to, you are in a remote context, so it's like the person walking you through the office the first time, and they are in charge of the first 3 months of onboarding, I think, where they will show you where to find the documentation. They have, in the beginning, a weekly check-in. After it's like bi-weekly or something where they follow up. And the funny thing with that is that we see most of the buddies and the person they onboarded, they have a good relationship throughout their career in the company because they started, they were paired up in the beginning. So yeah, that's one thing that we do. We do have a little bit more like informal mentorships where people say, I want to level up on these kind of things. Can you assign me someone who has experience in that? And actually, as a company, we provide mentorship for CTOs as well. So we call CTO coaching or CTO soundboard, where basically typically it's like 1 or 2 hours per week. If a CTO needs someone to talk with on a technical level, we pair them up with one of our CTOs and we help them that way in a very informal setting where they basically bring a problem and we try to discuss it together, like what we would do.
Is there any like formal feedback process involved in that buddy system?
Not necessarily in the buddy system, but we have a feedback process in general, which is pretty rigid. So we have a semester review. So every 6 months, everyone goes through a review process. It's not like everyone goes through the process at the same time, but basically after the 6 months, you get your first review moment. And that's pretty formalized. We collect feedback from peers on that as well. And of course, if it's a newcomer, we will also discuss how it went with the buddy and all of that. But it's not that the buddy is going to judge over the person because the buddy is a peer. It's not a manager. Yeah.
Okay, understood. Are you strict on also letting people go again or?
Yeah. We have a podcast episode on that with Jason Freight. They have this system that after 1 year, if you ask the question, would I hire this person again? The answer is no. They'll fire the person. That's a very American way of doing things, I guess. But we have a pretty strict, I would say hire slow, fire fast. I mean, if you have the feeling that it's not working out with a person, for either side, it's just better to make that clear and to express that. Of course, you first want to have some conversations. Okay, what is happening? Why is it happening? Is there anything we can do to improve the situation? And if we don't see that moving towards the direction that we want to see it moving, then we're most of the time pretty quickly also in making the decision. But it's never unexpected for the person because we already had a couple of conversations with them about the performance, for example. But it's not that we have this kind of after a year where we've revised. No, that's not something that we would do.
Okay, cool. One concept that you also kind of shape or that maybe also shapes your company and the motivation, supports the motivation and culture of your team is that you tend to also sometimes say no to a client, right? The idea of client selection. Like, what are your thoughts behind it?
In our case, I mean, for me, it's very important that we know that we can make an impact on the company. So if we have the feeling, for example, we're not fully supported on all levels, for us, it doesn't make really sense to start because, for the work we do, we need to have full support of a team. And that's from the board level towards the engineers and everyone in between. So that's the first thing. But also, I mean, we have a checklist of like what kind of companies we want to get involved in. So ethical wise, so we're not going to do oil industry, oil and gas industry. We're not going to go into gambling, for example. So we have pretty strict rules on that as well. But then, saying no, I mean, towards the clients in terms of taking on a project is one thing. But then once we're in a company, I mean, I guess half of or even more of the work of what we're doing is saying, no, we're not going to do that this way, or no, we want to do it differently. So we say no a lot to our customers, and that's what they hire us for, actually, in the end. And in our case, the customer is not king. I think that's very important, and people know that as well. In the end, we want to do the best for the company, and that does not always mean that we're following, like, for example, the CTO or the CEO who has a certain idea, if we are not 100% sure that that's the right thing for the company in the end. So that's why we say no a lot, yeah.
What about what client types do you actually support? Like, would you also work for agencies, or like, what's the typical client?
Yeah, it's B2B SaaS companies. Sometimes it's a little bit different than that, but that's our main target group, I guess. Sometimes it's with an IoT component or a little bit of a marketplace, but most of the time it's B2B SaaS. Sometimes it's B2C, but we focus on that because we care about the fact that what we work on is basically what they make money with. Because if you're working on a more of a supporting or a utility thing in a company, the budget are different, the care of the team on the client side is different. It's more of a buy thing that they need to take care of rather than something that they're really invested in taking care of. So that's why we believe we only want to work on the heart of the business, like we like to say it. And yeah, so B2B SaaS, Series A to B, that's like where we're, that's our sweet spot. So we bring them from Series A to B, we help with that scaling, and
that resonates quite well with how we choose companies to acquire at SaaS Group. So the cultural aspect is huge, because I mean, we keep companies independent and want to give them like freedom and developing their direction, but we still believe that there's a lot of common ground and a lot of knowledge sharing that is really like good for the people and motivating. Mm-hmm. So that said, you also work with acquisitions and do a lot of like tech and product due diligence. Mm-hmm. What's your approach to it? Have you seen like really extreme bad practices?
Bad practices in terms of what companies are doing, or bad practices in terms of due diligence on these kind of deals?
What companies are doing and how they do the stuff they do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. To give you an idea, I think we audited over almost 200 companies now. So we've seen lots of things. At the moment, we're auditing two companies per week. So, I mean, we're seeing lots of stuff. And you see the extremes. And I think it's all about, this kind of maturity model where basically from one company, given their size, given their team, you expect them to be at a certain place in their life cycle. And then always the question is like, we expect them, before we start auditing, we expect them to be here. And then when you audit, you see that they are either below or above expectation. So I think it's a very hard question to ask, because there is lots of different things that we see. I think there is some patterns, of course. There is companies, for example, what we see regularly is companies, for example, that started from a consulting business. So there is a consulting business. They have like an idea of, okay, we're doing the same thing for our customers all the time. Let's make a product out of it. In those kind of cases, for example, we very often see that they have a hard time letting go the kind of custom stuff, doing custom stuff for customers. That basically makes that onboarding customers takes a lot of time and effort to do that, or that they have a lot of customizations and their product is really bloated with features because this client wants this feature, that client wants that feature, or that they even still develop features specific for customers. That's what you get when you go out of a consulting business. And of course, that does not scale properly. Unless you're an enterprise and you realize that, I mean, the service fees you're asking for using your service are very expensive. If that's not the case, I mean, that's not scaling at all. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of the things that we see when consulting business starts a product. That's a pitfall. Something that we also see a lot in smaller companies, especially that are founded by non-technical founders, is that they don't really understand the protection of their IP. So if you are a non-technical founder and you have like a subcontractor or a freelancer make your product, right? That's totally fine. Of course, it's a good idea to do that if you're not technical yourself. But then at one point in time, hopefully, you bring that code base in-house and you have people in-house taking it over.
Yeah.
Or you work with another freelancer or whatever.
Yeah.
But what we see very often, and it's always interesting to see how lawyers don't really understand that, is that there is no transfer of the intellectual property done. So you work with this third-party agency to build it. You don't really have a contract with it. And basically, you just pay the invoices. And then sometimes even like years later, we had a case like I think 3 years later, they were going to get acquired. And then we started looking at the code base and we were asking like, okay, who contributed to it? And then it turned out, okay, it was like three different vendors that contributed to the code base. And it turned out that there was no contracts with them. So from the legal perspective, so in the legal due diligence, they didn't see anything because there was no contracts. In legal due diligence, they only review the contracts that are there. But here, basically, they ask friends and agencies they know to work on it, but they had no formal agreements with them. So the IP was actually not transferred because it was not written. It was not contractually written down. So that means that the IP stays with the person who wrote it. And of course, you can use it, but that does not mean that the person that wrote it at one point in time can come and say, okay, this is my IP, you cannot use it anymore. Because that's how IP law works. And so then we flagged that, like, do you know that there were like three other vendors that worked in this source code and they were not aware from a legal perspective? So basically they were selling source code that was not their own. So the company had to go to the different vendors and make agreements with them to basically acquire the IP as well. In this case, it was just about signing a paper, but sometimes it gets into a legal battle as well.
Yeah. Especially if you announce that you have been acquired and then the people wrote the code basically realize that.
Yeah.
And then you have to kind of convince them to sign your letters. That's really
absolutely
hard, right?
And it's if you work with a development agency, for example, they'll often give you the code on a license and not full ownership. And that's, for example, a very big pitfall. You think as a founder, okay, license is fine, but to sell the code, it's not. So that's one thing. Another thing is venture studios. So there's quite some companies being funded from venture studios. And what we see there a lot is that they use common components, for example. So that basically venture studio has some kind of foundation to build a product on and that they then for each venture just continue building on that foundation. And then the problem is, of course, if you're building on that foundation and the venture studio is maintaining that foundation, and if you're then going to get acquired, how does that work? Also, there sometimes it's licensed. Then even if the venture studio says, okay, it's licensed, but you can use it forever. I mean, who's going to be responsible for the maintenance of it? You're building your whole business on something that you don't control, which is risky. What if they stop supporting? What if they cease to exist? You're not getting the security upgrades anymore. You have to take care of it yourself. So there was there's quite some things to that as well. So this whole kind of IP and licensing and dependency is always a struggle. And it's definitely something that in an acquisition process is something that you have to be very, very careful of. And I don't know if I answered your question with that, but just wanted to point that out.
You did. You basically also answered my next question, which would have been about like the things that often are overlooked in due diligences. Maybe like one last DD question would be like, what would you recommend for CTOs or leaders to kind of best prepare for tech DDs?
Yeah. So our approach is that you don't need to prepare at all. And we do that very deliberately. So there's other companies that send you like a questionnaire or a full list of documents you need to provide. And it's a very stressful thing to go through. And I don't believe in that because that mentally already prepares the people that we're going to interview for the questions they're going to have. And they'll get on the defensive very quickly. We do it the other way around. So we don't ask anything upfront and we try to make the process as easy as possible for the target company. So it's an enjoyable experience for them. We ask feedback also after every interview and our feedback is always positive. I mean, very rarely it's not, and then it's because of it's a hostile environment or whatever. But in general, it's a positive experience for the people being audited. And that's for me the only way to get the real information out of the company. I'll give you one example. So we had a company that we audited for the Series A. And there were lots of red flags in that audit. And so the investor told us, okay, we're still going to invest in them because we believe in the company, but we are aware of the fact that in the engineering team, there's quite some work that needs to be done. We told them, for example, that probably they will have to replace the CTO. They said, okay, let's let's continue with the CTO we have. But yeah, we know what to work on. So we hope that they will progress on those points. And so they also immediately said, okay, as part of the deal, after 6 months, we'll do another audit to see if things improved, right? And that, I mean, so we did. Actually, we did even one more time after that. But so in the first intermediate audits, after the 6 months after the investment, we audited them again. And of course, they knew what to expect because we audited them already before. And so when we started doing the interviews, it was, so one of the points, for example, was that they didn't have any project management system in place. So they were like, okay, we're going to implement Scrum. Yeah, whatever. I don't care what you have as long as you have something. So they were like, we have a conversation with the CTO and we asked them, like, okay, what's your stance on project management? Yeah, we use Scrum and this is how we do it. And he shows us a sprint board and it all looks great. Okay. And so we base ourselves on interviews. So we interview up to 8 people typically. So we continue our interviews. We go with one of the project managers. Yeah, we do Scrum. It's something that we started doing recently. And I asked them, like, okay, show me your Scrum board, right? Show me the documentation on the Scrum process. And then you see that the documentation page has been made like 3 days ago. And then you start asking the engineers, like, okay, of course, you ask them, like, okay, what kind of process do you use? Yeah, we use Scrum. And then you ask them, okay, and can you explain the process? And like, yeah, but it's only something recent. They've only been briefed recently, so I don't really know what it is about. And then basically it turns out that they're not applying it at all. But the CTO just told everyone, you have to tell that we're doing Scrum. And so the only way to find that out is by doing interviews and having conversations with real people. No automated system is going to find that.
Ideally, all at once, right? Like you have 8 people doing 8 interviews at once.
I mean, we have a very good approach. And I mean, of course, we are very experienced in doing that. And I think we get the truth out of a company most of the time. And yeah, especially if you're talking with lots of people and if you make them at ease, you get the value out of it that you want to get. And people in general are honest. They want to share what they know. And it's also in the benefit of the company to be transparent, because if then later on it turns out there is no Scrum process in place and it's crappy what you have, I mean, it's not in the benefit of anyone to fake that. That's what we kind of try to do with our artists as well.
Yeah. I also have the opinion that, like, ideally a TechDD is an enjoyable process or a good conversation you have with a fellow CTO, right? Like, be as honest as possible, because, like, it will come out anyway, right?
How I always compare it, and how I explain to founders what we're doing as auditors is, we're not a judge, right? We're not a judge telling you yes or no towards an investor. That's absolutely not what we are. The judge in the end is the investor or the investment committee. What we are is the lawyers, right? We are defending the case of the startup or the target company. And basically what we need to do in our due diligence is to get all the information we need to make our case towards the investor. And we will try to defend the company, because in the end, it's also most of the time we have the contract directly with the company, because that's how it works. So our job is to defend the company, tell the truth, be honest about the situation, but also to say, okay, yes, they've made mistakes in the past, but we believe that they are capable of fixing those. Or yes, we know they did things wrong and maybe they don't know how to fix them, but they're eager or they're willing to change and they're willing to accept advice. And sometimes you are a lawyer and that has to come into a courtroom and we say, yes, my client is not with me. He does not want to talk with me. And I'm very, yes, he committed the crime, is guilty on all pledges, right? And that's, of course, a situation you hope you don't get into. Sometimes that happens, but that's kind of how I compare it. And so if a company provides us with the right information and is very collaborative in the process, we can do a better defense towards the investor while doing so.
Cool. Thanks a lot. A lot of valuable input and things I might even be able to apply at work. Like, coming to the end, maybe you have just one cultural hack that would help everyone out there to do their job better in a remote setup.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say, first of all, hire public speakers. So if you hire people that are not afraid of talking, and I'm not going to say they all need to be extroverts, right? But if you hire people that can go on stage and talk in a remote context, it's highly beneficial, right? Because they can express themselves clearly. That's one thing. And second, the most important thing I think I can recommend to remote companies, especially engineering teams, is have an internal culture of knowledge sharing. And the easiest way to do that is through an internal blog. So we have an internal blog where people can write. It's internal, so it's not public. People can write, okay, I've had this situation with this customer. This is how we solved it. Or I've seen this information. And we have it on a blog because it's, if you put it in Slack, it's like fluid. It goes away, right? On a blog, it's like you take a little bit more time to explain it, and you can have a good conversation. And also you can go back to it. And that really helps us as a team to level up and to learn from each other as well. So doing an internal blog is definitely something that I would recommend everyone to do.
Thanks a lot, Andreas. A lot of beefy content here. It was a great recording. Thanks a lot. I hope we collaborate in a certain, soon to come tech DD. and see each other again. Very, very nice recording. Thanks a lot. Have a
Thank
great day.
You. Have a good rest of your day.
Bye.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.